Hello, and welcome to episode 26 of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Nick Zoutra. Today on the podcast, I am pleased to welcome Dr. Tony Shimero, Professor of Philosophy and Psychology at the University of Cincinnati. Tony got his PhD in Philosophy and Cognitive Science from Indiana University in 1999. From then to 2012, he taught at Franklin and Marshall College, where he was Professor of Psychology. In 2012, he became Professor of Philosophy and Psychology at the University of Cincinnati. Tony's research is both philosophical and empirical. It is focused on questions related to dynamical modeling, ecological psychology, artificial life, and complex systems. He is author of more than 70 research articles and the book Radical Embodied Cognitive Science, which was a finalist for the Lakatos Award. His second book, co-authored with Stephen Koffer, will appear on Polity Press. He is currently editing the second edition of the MIT Encyclopedia of the Cognitive Sciences. And thus, without further ado, let's bring in Tony. Well, yeah. let's get started back at the beginning, Tony, and let's describe where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town in Connecticut, New Milford, Connecticut, kind of northwest, very rural, but also kind of close enough where you could kind of get on a train and get to New York City. So I think it's a good place to grow up. I had the best of both worlds, right? As a kid, there was a cow pasture across the street that we would play in, and then, you know, we could go to New York City for baseball games and stuff like that.
Okay. Did you have a favorite baseball team?
I'm genetically a Yankees fan. I think, you know, I'm not proud of it. I just can't help it. The evil empire. I've been baseball and Yankee fan since I was 5 years old. But not just for baseball games, but, you know, in high school, I could get on the train and go to museums or go, you know, hang out in the East Village and try to seem like I was punk rock.
So
a kid from the sticks.
Yeah. So it sounds like you were pretty connected with growing up at certain points, going out to New York quite a bit.
We would go regularly as a family when I was growing up. And then when I was in high school, you know, you could just get on the train. So we'd go pretty regularly to museums or to just to again, hang out and go to record stores and stuff like that.
Okay. That sounds fun. If you don't mind me asking, what were your parents up to at the time?
My parents, my mother was a real estate agent. And my father was a contractor and carpenter. When I was in high school, he had a heart attack. So he ended up being unable to work for, the last almost 30 years of his life.
Oh, wow.
He was bored a lot because, you know, sure. He was still pretty young, but he also, you know, so he wasn't able to work. So he was around a lot. He ended up doing kind of a lot of the house stuff while my mom worked more and more. It was non-traditional in that sense, I guess, a way that's getting more common now for the mother to be the one who works and the father to stay home. But at the time it was pretty unusual.
Sure. So did you, what were their, you know, in terms of, I should say, like, you know, professional, you know, their expectations for you. What kinds of things were your folks talking about in terms of what they, you know, what did they encourage you to do?
Yeah. So neither of my parents went to college. I think I'm the first person with my name ever to go to college. My last name.
There
aren't many of us. But you know, they saved and sacrificed a lot so I could go. Their expectations were always that my brother and I would go to college.
Were you officially a first generation student in your family?
Yes, I'm a first generation student. Like most first generation students, I think my parents had expectations that, you know, I would be a doctor or a lawyer or something that would make a lot of money. Sure. And they were kind of surprised and disappointed, maybe. not maybe, definitely. I said I was going to wanted to study philosophy. So their expectations were that I would go do something that may be, you know, well off. Instead, I became a philosopher.
Okay. Well, so, you know, getting back into some of the adolescent years, what kinds of things were you interested in? Was philosophy on the radar at the time? Just other things in general?
You know, not philosophy wasn't really on the radar. I was interested in, you know, in the stuff teenagers are interested in, I guess. Yep. You know, sports and dating and you know, bad music.
You've mentioned going to record stores in the East Village. Were you really into music back then?
I was, and I guess I still am. And I guess I still like bad music. or music that a lot of people find hard to listen to. But yeah, I spend a lot of time doing that.
Was this like punk? You said some punk rock stuff. What was bad music for you?
Generally, kind of alternative music. So punk rock and industrial and things like that. I guess, you know, one of the things is that people my age, either you were a Cure person or a Smiths person. I was definitely a Cure person. Mm-hmm. I think there aren't very many mixed marriages that way. Let's see.
Wait, did you say the Cure?
Yeah, either you liked the Cure better or the Smiths better.
Gotcha.
And, you know, most people associate with people who like the same of them better.
Sure. I think that, well, the Cure is a definitely popular band, but the Smiths are supposedly much cooler to like, I think.
I think that's probably true. I
mean, maybe now, I don't know. Maybe back then it was probably different.
Yeah. What else? I always was really interested in math and science, but I was always better at word things like French and writing. So I guess it's kind of natural that I ended up a philosopher of science, but I didn't really think much about philosophy growing up. Really not at all.
But so were there, you know, any kinds of like questions you were interested in growing up or generally, I mean, going into school? I mean, maybe hard to think of that in terms of big conceptual questions, but, you know, were there certain things, I suppose, in school or out of school that interest you intellectually?
Yeah. So I think I kind of fancied myself an intellectual in high school. I liked abstract things a lot. I remember being in a U.S. history class and getting really worked up about, you know, justice and the social contract and things like that. And I basically read through the kind of what I thought of as the highfalutin literature section at our public library, our small public library. And I did read some philosophy back then, I guess, but mostly existentialist things. So plays primarily and novels by existentialists.
So some Sartre
Sartre and Camus and people like that. I never thought of myself as, you know, being interested in philosophy. I just thought of myself as generally intellectual. I guess I was a pompous little prick, if you think about it.
A brooding adolescent that, you know, read these existentialist plays, whatnot.
Yeah, I think I did even used to wear a beret sometimes.
Okay.
Berets, but, you know, no clove cigarettes or anything. I'm making it sound different than it actually was. I really was more than that into, you know, sports.
Okay. Yeah. And that's fine. Yeah. That's what I found about folks. I mean, what kind of sports as well?
I played baseball and football in high school. We've met, so you know that I'm not very big.
Which positions did you play?
In baseball, I'm left-handed, so I played all the positions that left-handers can play, which is first base and outfield and pitching. Mm-hmm. And in football, I'm little and fast running, or fast-ish running.
Running so back? Or
a wide receiver and a defensive back.
Oh, very nice.
Again, at a certain point, people just lapped me in size, so football seemed like not a good thing to do. Mm-hmm. But I stuck with baseball.
Nice.
I still want to be a baseball player.
Yeah. Deep down, it's like one of these days, did you I mean, after, did you pursue it at all after high school or?
No. Okay. Again, I'm little and,
sure.
And it just didn't seem, I wasn't good enough to play at the college level.
Understood. Yeah. But okay. Okay. So, being into sports and whatnot, seems like a variety of things. You found your way into undergraduate. Is that correct? Or what was
going on? I went straight from high school to undergraduate. And I went to Tufts University.
That's right. Okay.
Because my parents, again, first generation student, I also understood that I was going to college to become wealthy, like my parents wanted me to. And so I started pre-med. Okay. And I finished. I did all the pre-med, even though I knew quickly I didn't want to go to med school.
What told you that?
I guess it was the people who were at pre-med.
Yeah.
There was a kind of, so Tufts is a good university, and the people there could get into good medical school. So there was a kind of cutthroat way that they were. Mm. Like, you'd ask for help from your neighbor in lab and they wouldn't help you. Oh. And I realized I just didn't want to spend my life around people like that.
Yeah.
And also I kind of realized that I wanted to be a doctor so I could make money. And I didn't think that was a noble thing.
Yeah, sure.
So I also, to be honest, just realized as soon as I met him that I wanted to be Dan Dennett.
Mm. Yeah, because I know Dennett was and is at Tufts.
That's right. Yeah. And that's kind of what drew me to philosophy. Just, reading things by him, meeting him, seeing the stuff that he was doing. Mm-hmm. I realized that that's what I want to be when I grow up.
Yeah. So can you remember some of the first times you might have come in contact with or met Dan?
I saw him give a talk, on campus about something. And I just remember thinking that, if that's what philosophers do, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
I didn't take a class with him formally till I think my junior or senior year, but, I'd see him around and I was reading his work and I knew his reputation. And he was supposed to be, eventually he was going to be my senior thesis advisor, except for he talked me out of my senior thesis being interesting. He said that if you know his work, he doesn't have very much patience for a lot of philosophical problems. And I was very interested in free will. And uh-huh. He thought that that was, not worth taking seriously in the way I was taking it. Mm. And, I think he was right. But at the time he made me really sad.
Yeah. Imagine.
So. But no, he was a great teacher and mentor, and, I'm, happy to have spent time with him.
Yeah. It's tough to be told though, that, an idea that you're really excited about isn't worth pursuing by someone.
This was the late 1980s. And, mm-hmm. I was really interested in what we now call nonlinear dynamic systems. Back then that was called chaos. Mm-hmm. And I had this idea that if your brains had a lot of chaos in them, that might be a way to kind of get between determinism and libertarianism and free will. I see that as kind of a naive idea now. And he was right that it was kind of a naive idea. But it definitely was very exciting to me when I was 19 or 20 years old.
Sure.
So he talked me out of that. But I did, take several classes with him and talked with him a lot. And, I can't overestimate how influenced I am by him. But also at the time, I had classes with George Smith as well, who's a Newton scholar. That made me realize that I really wanted to, be Dan Dennett, but I wanted to do philosophy of science.
Yeah. So what was it about interacting with George Smith that was that you appreciated. Obviously, I think most folks would be more familiar with Dennett just as a popular standpoint. But what was it about George Smith that excited you?
Well, for one, he was just hands down the best teacher I've ever had. Just as far as his kind of patience and willingness to take time and explain and read work, just an amazing teacher. It's fun to think about the history of science, right? Because what you realize is that people who are way smarter than you believed lots of things that now seem kind of dumb. And yet how people got to those beliefs that we now think are dumb seemed really exciting to me at the time. And I still think it's really fun to think about. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of the way he would weave history into the philosophy of science that was really exciting to me.
Great, great. So did you end up doing some kind of philosophy of science senior thesis?
Senior theses were an option. You didn't have to do it.
Oh, okay.
I ended up basically double majoring in philosophy, though. I took almost all the philosophy classes that were available. I think my last year, I probably took 6 or 7 philosophy courses of the 8 courses I took. So, I didn't do a senior thesis on philosophy of science, but I was, taking all the logic and philosophy of science and history of science that I could, along with, philosophy of mind as well.
Hmm. Okay. So you had begun in pre-med, but found this wasn't his particular interest. So by the end of your undergraduate, what were you thinking in terms of, where did you want to go next?
Well, at a certain point I was kind of choosing between wanting to be a creative writer or a philosopher.
Okay.
And you occasionally try to be objective about your own life. It's not easy. But what I realized is that I had consistently gotten a lot more praise and a lot more positive attention for my work in philosophy than I had for any fiction that I'd written.
So what kind of creative writing? Yeah. So you were, what kinds of stuff were you writing?
Fiction. Well, what I was really writing was, I guess, short stories that were basically philosophy puzzles made into a narrative. It just seemed like philosophy was the thing that was going to be what I could do well. Mm-hmm. In addition to all this, as I said, when I was really young, not when I was really young, growing up, I was always way more interested in science than I was in literature or writing. I loved science. I just wasn't as good at it as I was at literature and writing.
Yeah.
So I definitely wanted to do something to do with science. And I just thought that, the way that people like Dan Dennett would like weave neuroscience and artificial intelligence and psychology into their philosophy was really exciting. So that's what I wanted to do, I guess. By the time I graduated from college, I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Fantastic. It's interesting. I've talked with a couple of folks who've, philosophers of science who've also had some previous fiction writing careers, some even current writing careers where they, have homepages and they're writing their own, they've published some science fiction or, done some, writing. Is this something you've still pursued I guess I was more curious is whether you feel I'm always curious about ways in which to explain and present good philosophical work. Is a narrative style ever useful in maybe a philosophical context, or is it more to be seen as more just appreciative in a literature context?
A lot of fiction is kind of written around philosophical problems. Mm-hmm. And narrative certainly makes things more accessible than if you start by writing a bunch of definitions or something like that. Right. So a narrative can be really useful. I mean, it's just, I guess what counts as what counts as professional philosophy now, professional level philosophy, mm-hmm. requires a kind of specificity and subtleness and I guess mostly specificity that's hard to get across in an interesting story.
Yeah.
I mean, most interesting fiction, at least what I find interesting, always has some kind of lots of room for interpretation and questions you can be asking. And, you know, philosophy, if a philosophy article is written well nowadays, we say, I know exactly what that person was trying to say, right? That's kind of what we're trained to do and what you're being trained to do now.
Yes. Right?
Be really, really crystal clear and leave no questions.
Mm-hmm. Which is not necessarily the greatest for fiction.
No, it's not. It's not. It's kind of, I mean,
the opposite, perhaps.
Yeah, the opposite. I mean, it's kind of, and I think a lot of philosophy, you know, I spent a lot of time reading philosophy. I spent a lot of my time writing philosophy, and a lot of it is just boring, right? In a way that you wouldn't read for pleasure.
Sure. Like, it's significant. It's worth doing. I mean, it's, you know, it needs to be done in a certain way. Often, I mean, you could write in an extremely technical way, like a technical manual would, perhaps. But yeah, I suppose then the room for narrative writing, I mean, people, you could probably easily argue that in terms of engaging others into philosophical ideas, and this is the way that many popular writers have taken with, you know, going away from, like, when they don't write professional philosophy, they'll write some, at least maybe like an introduction to a chapter will be a narrative or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are ways in which you can incorporate that, especially if you're writing a longer work. If you're writing, you can incorporate narrative into something that, you know, doesn't have a 5,000 word limit. Right. So, I mean, I think you can do it, but you know, that's when you're writing a book, maybe instead of a journal article.
You're right. I was thinking, it's always just been fun when some books have started with some playful dialogues, for example, and then they get into the, you know, professional philosophy. But you're right, a 5,000 word limit, you're not going to have a lot of room to play around with that, nor would it necessarily be valued.
And I think that one of the things that we've done, by we, I mean, you know, philosophers for the last 100 years or so, have kind of made it so that regular people can't care about what we do. Right? Because there's so much background required. And it's disappointing in a lot of ways. Because some of it is genuinely interesting and is worthwhile for people, even people who aren't kind of dug into the debates. And I would love it if we could find a way to make complicated philosophical debates more accessible. It's a disappointing thing about our discipline is that you can't make people see why it's important sometimes.
Yeah. So there's a couple engagement projects, folks. There's this Wi-Fi philosophy or something, basically where they're making videos and trying to make them more accessible, where they're explaining, people can submit their problems or concepts, but it's rarely the case that current up-to-date discussions are being explained in this kind of way. It's only, you know, years later that these kind of more simplified versions of the problems are being presented. And so it's hard to stay like necessarily current. And there's also not a whole lot of necessarily good, well, you know, we have science writing. We don't science writers who aren't necessarily scientists, but who are journalists who describe scientific ideas in accessible ways. There aren't a whole lot of philosophy writers.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I occasionally have been asked to do presentations for more general audiences. And it's really daunting to try to explain, you know, the stuff that I do without equations, right? Or without, without really technical terms from complex systems or from psychology or from philosophy. I mean, they just always all end up there. And the thing is that the more of them you add, the, you know, every equation you put in a book, you lose a reader, right? So it's hard to be not narrow and be good at the same time.
Yeah. Good to at least, I suppose, be aware of this fact, but you're absolutely right. Yeah, something to.
So there's this really great documentary. Basically, it's not even a documentary. Someone just found a bunch of old, never before seen Thelonious Monk footage, where he's, you know, it shows him talking to his band about the music that they're going to make, and he said it has to be good, but it also has to be so people can dig it.
Mm.
And like, you want both of those things, right?
Yeah,
that's what you want, but it's really hard. It's a challenge.
Yeah, yeah, that is. Yeah, I suppose I mean, there are certain ways that I'm sure folks, you yourself probably have certain tricks. I wouldn't necessarily call them tricks, but ways in which to engage people that people come back to your work. And certainly, for example, Dennett has had a way with that too. Has created a way of being accessible. And maybe you could comment, you know, what is it, before we get back to some of the origin stuff, what is it then that in your writing or maybe folks that you've seen that you like that can make philosophy a little bit more accessible?
Well, I mean, one of the things about people like Dennett or Andy Clark, who, you know, just write so beautifully, and write in a way that they can make other people care, is that they, you know, they don't get into lots of the nitty gritty, right? So, you know, you're not going to read an article by Dennett in which he is, you know, I'm going to use this article to reply to every criticism of my work.
Sure.
Because the criticisms are often technical, right? And I think that what people like, and Jesse Prinz does this as well, people who, and again, I can make a list. You know, the people who just write in a way that regular people can care about, they do so by, you know, hiding some of the details behind curtains, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the things about people like that I mentioned is they have done enough of the technical nitty gritty philosophy work to have earned the right, earned the trust to hide things behind the curtain, right? You know, and when you're reading, whenever you're reading up kind of popularization of something, one of the things that makes you just want to stop. Right. Is that when the person, you're trusting the person on details that they're not telling you about. But then when they say something that you know to be untrue, mm-hmm. because you happen to be an expert in that area, then you're just like, okay, I don't trust them on anything else now.
Oh, no. Yeah. Yeah.
So, often when you read books written by scientists or philosophers, mostly scientists, though, for larger audiences, you'll get to the point where you're like, oh, I no longer trust them on the stuff I don't understand because they made this stupid mistake on the stuff I do understand.
Oh, jeez.
So you have to put the right stuff behind the curtain, I guess, is what I'm trying to get across.
Yeah, and it's certainly the case that the folks are going to be wrong, but it's hard to, as you know, I imagine as yourself an expert in certain areas, it's hard to see such blatant mistakes in popular writing that you're going to want to continue at all.
Yeah, it happens.
Okay, so before you got to be an expert, you were a budding undergraduate. What happened next after Tufts?
I mentioned before my parents didn't have a lot of money at this point. I just didn't have the money to apply to grad school when I was a senior in college. And I was working two jobs. And I just didn't have the time or money to apply. So I had a year in between, which I spent, living in Boston working as a bartender.
Okay.
At a not very nice bar where people I would have to say, hey, can you please not do cocaine on the bar?
So Boston, like Boston is really what Boston is, right? I just kind of,
yeah, that's right. And then I, applied to graduate school during that off year, and I was really focused on places that I could do both. We were strong in both cognitive science and philosophy of science. Uh-huh. And I ended up going to Indiana. At a certain point, I realized that even if I get in everywhere, I probably have to move to Indiana, which didn't seem very appealing.
I no comment on that, but yeah.
Well, so, And the thing that was kind of decisive about that is that, you know, I had this, I mentioned earlier, the senior thesis that never was, mm-hmm. which was, I was really interested in nonlinear dynamics and chaos, and the cognitive science people at Indiana were doing a ton of that.
Yep.
So that was kind of one of the decisive factors that led me there. So that's what happened. You know, again, as you know, Indiana's strong in philosophy of science, and has the mm-hmm. cognitive science PhD program.
Yep.
So that's what made me move there. And, you know, to be fair, although I did cry on the drive from Boston to Indiana.
Where was the drive from again?
From Boston.
Okay. Yeah. It's not like you're going toward amazing, you know, nature preserves or anything like that.
Right. I did really like Bloomington by the time I left. I mean, I came to really like it. But there was culture shock. And you know, one of the things I realized pretty quickly, living in Indiana is mm-hmm. that people from the Northeast are assholes. And I was one of them. I mean, that it's just there's a kind of much more polite, much more slow demeanor that people have, and people are friendly. And for the first few months, I was kind of taken aback by how nice everyone was being to me.
Yeah.
For no reason. Like, why are you being nice to me? It's just what people are like there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I came to really like it. Anyway, I came to really like Bloomington.
Cool. Cool. And so you said you did the cognitive science PhD program, or did you do philosophy or both?
So at the time didn't have a standalone cognitive science PhD. It had to be a double major PhD, basically.
Right.
So I was philosophy and cognitive science. Are you doing cognitive science as well, or are you just doing HPS?
I am. I'm doing HPS and cognitive science. So okay, the dual major.
Yeah. So they do now have a standalone, right?
Yes. Yes.
Just cognitive science. But no, that wasn't an option. I don't know if I would have done it if it were an option to me. And so, yeah, I did both. Although by the time I was going to defend my PhD, we realized that there was a problem, which is that nobody in philosophy was on my committee.
Mm.
So I ended up kind of really not spending. I ended up spending a lot of time hanging out with computer scientists and psychologists when I was there.
Oh, okay. Who did you hang out with?
So my advisor was Brian Cantwell Smith.
Okay.
Who was hired by computer science and cognitive science. And also he and Tim Van Gelder were both co-advised me. And Tim had moved to Australia. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of, you know, we had what Brian called the 3M reading group, minds, machines, and metaphysics. and one of our main contentions was that, you know, cognitive science is messed up because of all the damn psychology. We thought that, you know, philosophy and computer science were going to solve all the problems, and psychology was just kind of giving us all this useless data. I don't feel that way at all now. Obviously, you know, I was, as we'll get to, I guess, I was a psychology professor for a long time. So uh-huh. I still am a psychology professor. So I spent a lot of time with computer scientists. And when I finished, I was actually seeing the philosophy job market. And having taken a ton of logic, I realized that I was very close to a master's in computer science, which I ended up not finishing, because this is the kind of decisions you make when you are a grad student that, you know, if I started my job with my if I signed my first job contract with a PhD in hand instead of as an ABD or instead of not being done, I got a $4,000 extra salary.
Oh, no.
So
this is good to know. I didn't realize this.
So places do different things. But so sure. I basically, what to say is I sold my master's in computer science for $4,000. So I was taking the final class.
That's funny. I think my advisor, Colin, also happened to be doing computer science as well, during the graduate years. What was it about the computer science that you were drawn to?
Mostly I was just drawn to Brian Smith. I mean, he was fantastic as an advisor and just a super genius, mm-hmm. who I mean, one of the great tragedies of, I think, of cognitive science is that Brian doesn't publish enough. Let's see, you know, I'm going to tell you that here's the main thing that you need to learn when you're finishing your PhD is learn when things are good enough to submit. So Brian just never thinks things are good enough. So a lot of people are deprived of the kind of insights that he has. He really just has this one book that he published in the 90s called On the Origin of Objects, which, you know, he has probably five more books written, though. But yeah, so Brian is what drew me to computer science. And you know, just programming is fun. AI is fun. Robots are fun. So liked it. Yeah. It was fun to hang out over there.
Was he in psychology, you said, or was in?
No, he was in computer science.
Okay, yeah, that's right. I was a little bit, okay.
And also at the time, my office was in Rich Schifrin's lab. My job was working for the cognitive science program, so I spent a lot of time in the psychology building as well.
Okay. Yeah, Schifrin. Yeah, Sir Schifrin is still there. I'm trying to find to see if Brian is still around.
Brian left for Duke right after I left, and then he's now at University of Toronto.
Okay. All right, so what did you end up doing for the dissertation?
So my dissertation was about, so again, this is the, you know, mid-1990s, and Rodney Brooks is there, right? And Randy Beer, they're doing this great work in robotics, and then all the dynamical modeling. And the Porten van Gelderbroek Mind is Motion comes out, right? Yep. So what was really interesting to me at the time was whether the notion of mental representation actually had very much explanatory value in cognitive science.
Yep.
So that's what my dissertation was about. I was kind of digging through all of these explanations that roboticists and psychologists were putting up of cognitive processes and wondering whether when they used the term mental representation, whether it really had any grip or not, whether it actually did explanatory work. And that's what my dissertation was about.
So what did you think?
What I thought was that there were cases in which the term was being used where it wasn't useful. And that there were cases in which it wasn't being used that were justifiable. Right? So that is...
I'm curious about both, but the latter is interesting, or I just haven't heard as much about.
The idea is that there are certain ways in which, you know, say Randy Beer, you probably know Randy.
But
when he explains his little simulated guys, what he says that look. Most of them, when you look at the neural networks that are being used to generate the behavior, there's nothing in there that's sensibly called representation.
Sure.
And then other people, you can look at it and look at the details and say, oh, wait, no, there's the representation. There actually is a representation there. And people who do that basically want to define thinking, cognition, in terms of representation.
Yep.
Right? So what I was arguing in my dissertation, and I still believe, I mean, my book is partly... This is that there are lots of things that cognitive scientists are interested in that don't require representation to explain them, right? Of course, that doesn't mean that, you know, I can explain how I remember things without representations, but you know, I think I can explain how I catch a fly ball or how, you know, I reach and grasp something without thinking about representations.
So I'm curious. So this would be nice to get to eventually toward your. So did some of the work in your dissertation? I mean, was this sort of the foundation that has become the radical embodied cognitive science book?
Yeah. So I think there's certainly 1.5 chapters that were in the dissertation and that are in the book. Some of it certainly carried through. I mean, one way to think about it is that the project that was my dissertation morphed into the first part of that book, and then the second 2/3 were new.
Okay.
But it was definitely a continuation of the work I did in my dissertation.
Great, great. And we'll get to that. I'm curious, but just before we do, so finishing up at Indiana, what was your next step?
Well, so I was applying. I did the wretched APA job market like everybody had to at the time.
Yeah, I've heard about this, the interviews at the conference in the hotel room.
Horrible. I did that, and I didn't get any compelling offers until I got an offer for a job that was Franklin and Marshall College.
Okay.
Was advertising in psychology for a psychologist who knew a lot of philosophy for an interdisciplinary program they had called the Scientific and Philosophical Studies of Mind program.
Great.
And it was a 2-year job, and I got offered that. Shockingly, I got offered that. shockingly, for a lot of reasons. One is I know the people. I know who they interviewed because when I went for my interview, they actually had a list on the podium who the speakers were.
You knew who you were up against.
I knew who I was up against, and I should not have gotten that job. But also because I didn't really think I had a shot at a job in a psychology department. Because I spent all that time thinking that cognitive science had too much damn psychology in it. and part of what helped me get that job is I was I was in a reading group that were reading James Gibson's work.
Yeah.
So when they asked me if I could teach ecological psychology, I just said yes, even though it wasn't true.
Was this Bingham's course?
No, it was just a reading group. Some of Bingham's students, but it was, you know, again, it was mostly philosophers and computer scientists who were reading Gibson.
Okay.
Again, this is advice for anyone listening who's in grad school. If anyone asks if you can teach something on a job interview, the answer is always yes. Yeah,
of course. Learn it later.
That's really what got me the job. So suddenly I was a psychology professor.
Wow.
And I was there for this interdisciplinary program called Scientific and Philosophical Studies of Mind,
Actually. I believe we had a former guest on who did their undergraduate. Was it Colin?
It was Colin Klein.
Colin Klein. That's right. This sounds very familiar now. So he did his undergraduate.
Colin was, I was 29, 30 years old when I started the job, and Colin just seemed like a peer, right? He was an undergraduate who would come to class and he would take no notes. He would never write anything down, and he would get A's on everything, and he was just great. So Colin was my first, you know, my first student that I had really that I spent any time with. Colin was in this Scientific and Philosophical Studies of Mind major. There are quite a few other people that, you know, became successful who went through it. But it was an unusual thing because it was specifically not cognitive science. Because the people who started it were kind of had anti-cognitivist biases, right? Mm-hmm. So they wanted to do interdisciplinary philosophy psychology program, but they didn't want it to just be cognitive science. And that was where I was too. I mean, you know, because I went to school where you are, and people like Linda Smith were always saying, you know, the problem with cognitive science is that it's cognitivist, right? You can be a cognitive scientist without believing all these assumptions.
Yeah.
That thinking is computation and, you know, the whole story. So I fit in really well with what they were after. I guess that also helped me get the job. But suddenly I was a psychology professor. And I hadn't taken a psychology course. I guess I took stats and a cogneuro course in grad school, but I hadn't taken any other psychology since I was an undergraduate. So there was a pretty steep learning curve that first year. The psychology department there had an award for the best psychology student of the year, and I was arguing that I should get it because I learned way more than anyone else that first year I was there.
Wow. Okay. All right. So how long was your tenure at Franklin Marshall College?
So I was there 13 years. I was there for 13 years. And it was just a great place to work. Again, I was in the psychology department, but there was a lot of back and forth with philosophy because of this interdisciplinary program. It was just great. I had great students. People let me do what I wanted to do and say it was psychology.
Did you have an experimental program at all?
I advise students who did experiments. A lot of what we did were, robotics and simulations of things.
Okay.
But we did had an experimental research program. I, published a few experimental articles over the years, but mostly back then I was doing philosophy of cognitive science.
Right.
With some AI and robotics as a hobby, more or less.
Yeah.
But I came to realize through the course of this that, all that time I spent in grad school bashing psychology, I was wrong.
So explain to me why.
Well, so psychology is hard because nobody agrees about the nature of the subject matter. But the actual kind of digging in and finding stuff out instead of speculating about it and then building models that match your speculations is really valuable. One way to say it is that for philosophers of science is that there isn't really a paradigm that's shared by psychologists. But there are lots of kind of sub paradigms, and there's, Kuhn would talk about normal science being where all the work gets done. Mm-hmm. And there was lots of good, normal psychological science, but it was just siloed because there's no overarching paradigm that everybody believed.
Yep.
So there's tons of good work being done. And to kind of just speculate about how things work is, not always as useful as digging in and trying to find out.
Yeah.
I guess maybe I just drank the Kool-Aid in the psychology department.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I think that's a nice – a good meta analysis of the field. And, I know, I mean, even those in psychology are quite aware of the sub paradigms within the field itself.
Absolutely. I came to think of it this way because another lie I told at the job interview is that I knew about history of psychology. So I taught history of psychology for a long time and came to understand, actually I co-taught it with Fred Owens, who's recently retired. He's a perceptual psychologist who, was a fantastic mentor to me. I learned a ton just listening to him teach that. People think I know about it now, but really I just know what Fred taught me. I learned to think about psychology this way from talking to Fred all the time and sitting in class while he taught. We took turns teaching it, basically.
Okay. How was it teaching history?
Again, I had to learn it. But the way that Fred taught it and the way I modeled it on what he did is that you think about the kind of multiple battling paradigms throughout the history of psychology, and they're kind of back and forth all the time between Cartesians and Darwinists.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, and you can actually squeeze a lot of the history of psychology into this kind of basically pendulum swings between what's more popular, the Darwinism or Cartesian psychology.
Yeah.
There are things you can't fit in easily, like Gestalt doesn't fit in very easily, but you can actually tell a lot of the story that way. And it was really fun to learn it that way. And I still teach it that way. I teach now a graduate course on history and philosophy of psychology.
Oh,
using the same basic ideas.
Nice. I'd love to see the syllabus for that. That would be pretty great to see. What year did you start in at Franklin Marshall?
That was 1999.
Great. Okay.
I was 1999. And my first 2 years were as a visitor, and then I got a permanent job there. I did all of the professorial leaps there. I got tenure and promoted to full there as well.
Great. Was that all? How was that process of going through the promotion?
Well, so So I'm, you know, as I'm 48, I'm an old guy now. And one of the things I always say to people, and I think I got this from Fred too, which is that, you know, the way to get tenure is to be the kind of person who deserves tenure. Right? Yeah. There's nothing else you can say about it, right? The kind of person who deserves tenure is someone who does their job because they are passionate about it. And the kind of person who doesn't deserve tenure is the kind who thinks, well, if I get just this one more article published, that'll be enough to go up for tenure.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, if you don't think of, if you are really, you know, so, and I always was, I mean, I loved my job. I still do. So, you know, I was never, you know, when it came time to go up for tenure, it wasn't very stressful. I knew that I was, you know, I knew that I had met the expectations. And I always say this to, you know, junior faculty now, is just, you know, if you're the kind of person who should be given a more or less lifelong contract, you better be the kind of person who really loves their job and is good at it. And that's, you know, so the process, I guess, I wasn't very stressed out about it. Okay. Because I was just, yeah, I loved my job and I was decent at it. So yeah, I don't know.
I'm just curious. I mean, I actually, this is something I never typically actually ask guests. It's usually about how they eventually get the job, but then the tenure part, typically most of the folks I've talked to, they've been in the field for a while. So it seems like it's usually a straightforward thing. Although there can be complications with stuff.
I ended up on the committee that, you know, votes on who gets tenure for the college. The tenure, they called it the Professional Standards Committee there. But mm-hmm. It's basically mostly we spent our time on tenure and promotion, and it's really hard. These are hard decisions to make when you're on the other side of it, because you realize that, you know, what you're weighing is a really abstract thing, which is the kind of what standards of the institution versus a really concrete thing, which is someone's life.
Yeah.
Right? Because, you know, it's people who go up for tenure are usually of the age where they have young families, right? And, you know, so this, like, you know, this is, you're really harming somebody if you don't give them tenure.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, it's a really, you know, I know it's stressful. You're going to go through this. It's stressful, but at the same time, you know, it's really stressful on the other side as well. It's actually, I think it was more stressful to be on that committee than it was to be judged by that committee.
Well, it's sort of like you get it or you don't, rather than what are you going to, making the decisions right for others. I can see that. I can see that quite a bit.
I mean, one of the things that I came to realize on the committee that I didn't realize before is everyone thinks that there's like nefarious and political things going on, but what it really is just people trying really hard to figure out the solution to what can be really hard problems. Right.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, voting no on somebody up for tenure it's painful, right? Because you know that you're really harming them. So, I mean, it's,
well, you've talked about, you know, the fact that this won't negate the fact that it's really hard to vote no, but that, you know, the folks who don't deserve it you should do it in the sense, like, you know, getting tenure involves doing it such that it's clear that it's hopefully readily clear that you should. I imagine it's the cases where it's not, where it's, you know, and I don't really know what those would look like necessarily.
Here's the way to think it. Here's when it's hard, right? Is when there are people who you can tell. See, so it's hard because the people you can tell, they knew that there was a required number of publications, more or less, and they worked really hard to meet it, and they published a bunch in the last couple of years and without publishing much before. But then you say, so they're not the kind of person who obviously deserves tenure, but they've met the criteria, right? Those are the ones they all get tenure, right? The ones who don't are the ones who haven't met the criteria, even though they knew what they were, even if they were trying just to meet the basic criteria. Right, those are the ones that, you know, you vote no on, and even that's hard.
So what's an example of a base criteria for a philosopher? Or I imagine it's different in psychology. I mean, you're making decisions for psychologists as opposed to philosophers, so it's going to be different.
So when I was on the committee, I was on for the whole college.
Oh, okay.
And And so typically, you know, we would know that there are differences in disciplines. And, you know, so for at a liberal arts college where your teaching load is, you know, 5 classes a year, we would assume that people in the humanities would publish, you know, 1 article a year or near that.
Okay.
And people in the sciences would publish a little more.
Yep.
Because they're, you know, have lots of co-authors and...
Yeah. Have multiple experiments going on. And
yeah, that's right. It's easier to have lots of things going on in the sciences. But that's different, you know. So now at a big research place in the humanities, they expect you to have a book or 2 to get tenure. I mean, I guess the...
Is that even in philosophy or is that...
So, you know, in history,
sure.
Humanities. Yeah, definitely a book in the humanities.
Yeah.
Philosophy is a little different because philosophy, especially analytic philosophy, is a lot less systematic, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, there's a lot more work can be done in articles in analytic style philosophy.
Mm.
Right? I don't know. I mean, these are just assumptions that people make about... Like what if you do this, you'll be over the bar.
Yeah, sure.
But there are lots of other ways to be over the bar.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, when you think about what needs to be done to get tenure, you know, that's typically what it is. And in the humanities, at most places, it's an article a year mm-hmm. or a book or 2, depending on the, you know, probably, you know, if you were at Yale, it would be more.
Sure.
Than, you know, at Indiana or, you know, it changes.
Yeah. Yeah. Depending on the institution.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's, the best advice is just, you know, love your job and do it right. And you should be okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, which is totally useless advice, but it really is all you can say.
I've come across, I mean, even in graduate programs and whatnot, there's this tendency to obsess and over the criteria with what you need to do. Right. And it's unfortunate because really it's sort of like, I mean, and ideally if you focus on, you know, what it is, if you like doing this, do it a lot and the criteria will just come, like you'll just have the work produced. But of course, it's hard to not have some sort of foresight in terms of, okay, well, I can structure my time this way, et cetera, et cetera. But
right.
I definitely do get, it's unfortunate when I see and I hear on the halls more, just so much focus on the you know, box checking, I suppose, which again, needs to be done, but it seems like people are losing out on the, I don't know, the folks like you who are just super passionate. They know they love doing this. This is what they want to do. But I don't know. Yeah. So I suppose do you kind of see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, I say this to my grad students all the time is that, you know, I know there's a lot of work, but it's supposed to be kind of fun, right? If it's not kind of fun, you shouldn't want to do this with your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I agree. How far along are you?
I'm actually just starting my 5th year, so it'll be just finishing up. And since I did the dual major, I will be applying for jobs at the beginning of the 6th year.
It's stressful. But yeah, I mean, so actually these questions are actually relevant to someone at your stage. Like, you know, what is the tenure process like? And, you know, so good, good. And, yeah. And I'll say it again, the way to think about it is that, you know, if you like your job and you do it, and you know, you enjoy doing it, then a lot of these questions will just answer themselves about whether you're going to get tenure because you will have done enough.
Yeah.
And if you don't like your job, you know, and you're doing it just to get tenure so you can stop doing it so much, then you shouldn't, then, you know, you should maybe look for something else.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really good advice. Okay. So, appreciate you answering some of those questions about, just the promotion tenure process. Before we get on to where your current work, I know, so it was at this time at Franklin Marshall College that you wrote and produced your, a very popular book, Radical Embodied Cognitive Science, which I see here has many glowing reviews and recommendations by some of the top nonlinear folks in the field, you know. Could you tell me, maybe just for those who haven't read the book or haven't known too much about it, you know, what's the general idea and what it was like writing it?
Yeah, so I wrote it basically between 2004 and 2007. And I had one of the advantages of a liberal arts college, and there are lots of advantages to working at liberal arts colleges, is that there's just money flying around. So they often they called it junior faculty research leave. So I was able to take a year off from teaching to work on the book, and then I finished it after I got tenure in my first sabbatical. So I had two of those years in between there. I was not teaching and I wrote it then. And it took a really long time to get published. So the core of it came from my dissertation, which is I was interested in the question of whether there were good scientific psychology being done that did not traffic in the notion of mental representation. And what I realized hanging out with a bunch of psychologists is that there's a ton of it, and most of it was being done, or a lot of it was being done, by Gibsonian ecological psychologists. So what the book is about is it starts by saying, okay, how do we do cognitive science without invoking the notion of representation? Mm-hmm. And the tool, and I said that there's this tool that people use, nonlinear dynamical modeling, that doesn't necessarily involve representations. Like the idea of computation, I think most people would say that it does necessarily involve representation. Nonlinear dynamical modeling doesn't. And so that's a good modeling tool to do the science. And if you want to have a theoretical perspective on the science, some version of James Gibson's ecological psychology is a good place to start. So what I call radical embodied cognitive science is a practice that people engage in where they start with roughly Gibson's assumptions about perception being direct, about it being for guiding action, about it actually being action for the most part, and it being of affordances. Mm-hmm. That's your basic theoretical perspective, and then what you do to connect that perspective to messy data is use nonlinear dynamical modeling. Mm. So that's the basic story. And what I try to do is to say, look, philosophers are arguing a lot about whether it's possible to do psychology with representations or whether cognition is necessarily representational, all these things. But there are also a bunch of scientific psychologists out there who are just doing psychology without representations. Mm-hmm. So this practice exists on the ground, and what I try to do is kind of provide a philosophical story about the practice that exists.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And I try to answer philosophical questions given the assumptions that the practice uses. Maybe occasionally I feel like I wish that representational psychology would go away, but I don't think it will. I don't think there's any theory that psychologists use now that will believe in 100 years. I just think that right now, this nonlinear dynamical modeling coupled with Gibson's ecological psychology is a good way to do psychology. Mm-hmm. Not the only good way to do psychology, but it's a good way right now.
Yeah. It's a good.
So yeah. I'm like hedged as crazy.
You're like, this is it. Yeah. Okay. So how was the book? How was the book received?
I think that there's a group of psychologists who really like it, because I kind of said a lot of stuff that they hadn't articulated all the way yet, but believed. Mm-hmm. I think that I'm happy that it gets cited a lot, but I think people haven't read it who cite it. Because they say that I say a lot of things I don't say, like that there are no mental representations. For example, I never say that.
So it's kind of nice and interesting to hear. Well, the kind of more tempered, a clearer version of this with the title "Radical Embodied Cognitive Science." It seems like some might have taken it farther to say, "Yeah, are you making these stronger claims?"
Right. So that title is actually I stole it from Andy Clark, mm-hmm. Which he uses to talk about views that he doesn't believe.
It's a good title. It's a very good title.
It is a good title. I don't really like the book anymore, frankly. I wrote it, I finished it 10 years ago now.
That's right. I always love this one. Yeah. Okay. Books are just okay.
I think there's some good stuff in there, but there's a lot of stuff that I wish I'd done differently or that I don't think is important or interesting anymore. I mean, the most obvious thing that I think is a huge mistake in the book is I didn't take seriously that people would say that nonlinear dynamical modeling is not explanation. I mean, it seemed obvious to me that it was. In retrospect, I'm kind of shocked that, how much pushback that has gotten.
Yeah.
Because, I always say whenever people say, well, it's just calculus, how is that a scientific explanation? I just say, well, there's this thing, physics, right, which is all calculus. So that's, if you want to say that physics isn't explaining, or most physics isn't explaining anything either, I'll grant you that it's not explaining. But, I've been taken aback at how fervent that reaction has been, that this isn't really explanation.
Sure.
And I guess, I should have known better because of the explosion of interest in neomechanism.
Yeah.
But at the time I just thought that, neomechanists do that, mechanists' explanation is one thing. This is another thing, another kind of scientific explanation. So that's something I wish I had addressed in the book. Although I guess I've written a lot about it since then.
So what maybe you could clarify your views in terms of what you consider now, what would you say in terms of how nonlinear dynamical modeling relates to explanation?
Well, what I would say is that it's just a kind of explanation. Here's something I want to be careful about, right? Is I don't care about the word explanation.
Yeah.
But I think that it's a kind of extremely valuable thing that scientists do that sheds important light on lots of things that they're interested in. And it can be used to unify surprising things with one another, right? So, the fact that so much of human behavior is modeled using oscillators is really surprising, mm-hmm. right? So it can be used to unify apparently disparate things. It can be used to as a guide to discovering and a guide to doing experiments. And, so it does all these things that we want explanations to do. It also predicts. It does almost all of the things that we want scientific research to do other than describe a mechanism. Right? So if you want to say that explanation is necessarily mechanistic, then you can have the word explanation. But what I don't approve of is people denigrating this kind of research in any way by saying it's not an explanation. Mm.
And what is it? Is there? They say it because it's not mechanistic, and
that's the explanation.
Is that the gist of it?
The typical gist of it, yeah. And again, I think the work on neomechanism is great. I mean, Carl Craver, Bill Bechtel, Bob Richardson. These are great. This is great work. I feel what it is. Seems to be coming out of it is a kind of imperialism about explanation that is only mechanistic explanation is explanation.
Yeah. Well, my explanation is a huge topic in philosophy of science in general. And then across the different sciences and mechanism is, this is an interesting topic. Have you written specifically about this particular pushback?
I have a couple papers about it. One is co-authored with Nigel Stepp and Mike Turvey, where we – it's basically a response to Bechtel's mm-hmm. – Bechtel claiming that, you know, mechanistic philosophy of science is the philosophy of science for cognitive science.
Yeah.
So we were as a response to that. Then I have several papers with Michael Silberstein, mm-hmm. where we kind of look at examples in neuroscience and biology and cognitive science that seem to push the limits, push past the limits of what ought to be counted as a mechanism according to the criteria that mechanistic philosophers of science use. The main thing that we see a lot in biology is something that we, again, there are the words that aren't words for this kind of thing that are easy to use, but systems that are composed of components that are constrained by the system that they make up.
Uh-huh.
Right? So it's something that looks a lot like system to component causation or top down causation. And that's at least initially what neo-mechanist explanation was attempting to get rid of. Mm-hmm. But we see a lot of it in the biological sciences. And what's happened over the years is that, people have gone different ways, right? So Bill Bechtel has kind of expanded what he counts as mechanisms to include lots of circular causality and top-down causality and network causality. And other people have said that, well, yeah, that's not mechanistic, and so it's not actually an explanation.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, I think it's a mistake for philosophers of science to tell, hey, all you systems neuroscientists, what you're doing is not really explaining anything. I mean, there's certainly a prestige gap there. One of the things that I learned hanging around in a psychology department is that, you know, philosophical pronouncements on science are almost always naive.
Yeah.
The scientists are, you know, they're smart people, and they don't make the kind of mistakes that philosophers often accuse them of.
Yeah. Really? Okay. Well, I mean, So what do you have, maybe an example of this?
So let me say one thing is that scientists are not always, they're not sophisticated about philosophy a lot of times.
Yeah. But, yeah.
You know, when you look at people who say, who are critical of the assumptions that cognitivists make about whether there really are these processes happening in the brain. And you say, look, the brain isn't the kind of thing that could embody those processes. And I won't name names, but philosophers say things like that. Most psychologists are very knowledgeable about the relationship between the models that they're using and the phenomena that they're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think that I'm not saying anything controversial here, right? I mean,
no.
it's been for a long time that people have started looking at scientific practice as a guide to doing philosophy of science.
Yes.
You know, Alan Love is a great example of someone who does a really good job of that.
Yeah.
So, I think, what am I trying to say? When we talk about science as philosophers, we need to realize that we can't talk about it across the board. And the things that we might say that is true of cognitive scientists are not true of cognitive scientists. They might be true of a couple labs of cognitive scientists.
Yep.
They might not be true of all the cognitive scientists at the same university or in the same building. Right? I mean, so there's there's a lot more diversity in science than philosophers give credit to, and a lot more sophisticated understanding about the relationship between theories and models and systems, and, you know, even between data and phenomena. They know that they aren't the same thing, right? So I guess, I don't know, I get frustrated about people make pronouncements about how science works. I mean,
yeah,
you know, in your education, you're spending a lot of time around actually hanging out with scientists and seeing what they do. And that's a great thing about Indiana is that, you know, the philosophers of science there don't sit in a bubble, right? Mm-hmm. They know what's going on across campus, and they don't just know about the results of the experiments. They know what people are doing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, from day one, we've been encouraged. And most of us have, you know, previously come from areas where we were in labs. We work in labs. I think pretty much all the graduate students and then even the faculty are somehow mixed in some kind of experimental work, or at least, you know, heavily connected if they're doing philosophy of science.
Yeah, I think that's one of the good changes that's happened in philosophy of science is that it gets harder and harder to be taken seriously without some genuine experience in a science, either an undergraduate degree or a master's degree or work in a lab as a grad student. I mean, and that's as it should be, right? You know, I guess in the 1960s and 70s, people would think that, well, philosophy of science is just the kind of better modern day replacement for metaphysics and epistemology. But, you know, nowadays it's getting to be less and less that, right? It's getting to be, let's actually look at what scientists do. Because it's hard, you know, it's hard to kind of make critical pronouncements of something from the outside when that thing that you're making critical pronouncements on is on its face really successful.
Yeah. No, that is very true. That is very true. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So I wanted to jump ahead, at least just in the interest of time. You know, getting to sort of present day and, you know, you worked, working at Franklin and Marshall. So what happened? I mean, was this the jump to Cincinnati?
Yeah. So I was working there, at Franklin and Marshall as a psychology professor. And, you know, my wife is from the Midwest. We met in Indiana. She wanted to be back in the Midwest, to be near her family. And, you know, when University of Cincinnati called and asked if I wanted to come work here, I said yes right away. And so now I am, it's funny, my job is 51% philosophy and 49% psychology.
How did you work that out?
What it really is that I'm 50-50, but only philosophy is my boss. Only gotcha. They get to evaluate me. So that's why they have more than half, just so I only...
Sure,
I
mean, just to be clear.
You actually have to satisfy two bosses all the time, right? So that's the main reason that I have a greater percentage in philosophy. In fact, my work is half and half. Cincinnati was, you know, my wife wanted to be in the Midwest, but there weren't many places in the Midwest that I would fit. And Cincinnati is a really great place for me. It's probably the, you know... if not the one of the capitals of what I called radical embodied cognitive science in the psychology department. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of Gibsonian dynamical people here. Every year in the summer, we teach an advanced training institute on nonlinear dynamics in psychology. So I really, really fit in the psychology department. And in philosophy, you know, we're almost all philosophers of science in philosophy here. So they are actually philosophers who would understand that I'm one of them. And, you know, a lot of analytic style philosophy or philosophers or certainly continental style philosophers would not understand that I'm really one of them. Right? Because I do spend a lot of time in the lab, right? I do a lot of experiments. I do a lot of simulations. And, you know, that's not stuff that philosophers are recognized as being stuff that philosophers do in a lot of cases.
Yeah,
I think that's changing, but it's, you know, it's changing slowly.
Yeah. Agreed. So I see. Yeah, you have another colleague over there at Tom Polger, correct?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Tom is in philosophy. He's the head of philosophy now. He's somewhere between a philosopher of science and metaphysician. He has a great new book with Larry Shapiro on multiple realization. I don't agree with much of it, but I think it's really good. Fair. You know, we have a lot of philosophers of biology here. Bob Richardson, who I mentioned as a, you know, one of the prominent neomechanists, and Angela Potocnik is here, and Rob Skipper, Kofi Maglo does kind of bioethics and history of biology, and, you know, philosophers of cognitive science here too. Valerie Hardcastle, Peter Langland Hessen, I feel bad, I'm going to forget someone and get in trouble. Sure. Heidi Maybaum is another philosopher of cognitive science, philosopher of mind. It's just, you know, it's a place that I fit here in a way that I wouldn't fit in a lot of places. So I love my job. It's great.
That's fantastic. And I imagine, you know, being here, getting to interact with all these folks and then getting or having to travel is always something.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. I'm sorry to have started by griping about.
Oh, no, no. Hey, you know, you are where you like, you know, I think it's, I always appreciate just candidness and honesty in terms of just kind of what's, you know, what's, you know, what things are really like. And sometimes it's, you know, the demands of a very, you know, active profession can be, you know, demanding.
Yeah, and it's also, I also have teenagers now.
Oh.
And that's weird. One of the weird things about having teenagers is that they actually are more work than toddlers in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Because they can get into trouble. I mean, mm-hmm. I got into trouble as a teenager, and it's pretty easy to do. So they actually kind of take more attention in lots of ways. So that's part another reason that I don't like traveling as much as I used to, is the parenting is getting more demanding.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. I haven't thought about that as a not as a you know eventual parent myself, but it's something that it's not such that they can just grow up and they're just taking care of themselves. There's certainly more of a there's certainly more going on.
Yeah, that's right. So let's see. We were talking about Cincinnati.
So I mean, I was just curious. You know, sort of. So how do you like? Why don't we finish up with? Anything more you wanted to say about Cincinnati and what it's like over there?
You know, it's just a great place to work. We have a similar thing that to Bloomington. We have a philosophy of science. It's called Philosophy and the Life Sciences PhD program.
Yeah, I see it right here.
So it's kind of like philosophy and cognitive science there you could do. And the students are great. And, you know, I can't say enough about how much I like working here. I mean, it's great.
It sounds great. Yeah, it sounds.
And also this fellowship I have, the Taft Fellowship, actually doesn't count against my sabbatical. So it's like I basically get a sabbatical between sabbaticals, and it's just great. It's a great place to work.
Wow. This sounds great. So why don't we, you know, catch up to present day and I'm curious, you know, what's on the horizon for you, Tony? Like what kind of work are you, you know, hoping to do, or what kind of things are you excited about?
I've been getting Since I've gotten here, I've gotten more and more interested in social cognition. I've been here for about 5 years now. And I'm working on a book now about social cognition and what the things that people are learning about in social cognition mean about how to do science and also how what thinking is, what minds are. Mm. So it's kind of... I don't even know anymore whether I'm a philosopher of science or a cognitive scientist. I don't know. And this is somewhere in between there. What I'm interested in is the way in which people routinely but highly skillfully form social groups. And my colleague Mike Richardson, you know, is one who I think did the first really great work on this. When he studied the way people, if you just sit them down in rocking chairs, the way they coordinate their behavior unintentionally, but again, it's skillful because people can't do it. And the way people, when they're having a conversation, modulate their voices and their posture, all of these things basically make groups of people behave like biological units, just really short-lived ones. So I'm really interested in that. And the way to say it is that the easiest way to say it, I guess, is that if you look at a pair of people doing a task together and you measure almost anything about them, you know, the way they sway when they're standing, the words they use, the tone of voice that they share, they form a unit that is kind of like, say, the chambers of your heart in this kind of density of interconnection. And it's just a really short-lived one.
Yeah.
So I think this is a kind of fundamental thing about humans, is that we stick to each other in this way. And I'm interested in what that means about how to study people and about what people are.
Fantastic. So thinking of interaction as specifically interaction as either a biological unit or a biological process.
Yeah. I don't know what to call biological, behavioral.
Yeah. It's tough to say it's biological. Yeah. Well,
it's all of them. There's a technical term for it that people use is they call things interaction dominant systems.
Oh, okay.
This is what's interesting to me. This is why it's interesting. Interaction dominant systems are exactly the ones that mechanistic explanation has a hard time getting a grip on.
Yes. Okay, cool.
Because they are such that interaction dominant is kind of literal, right? The interactions are more important. Interactions dominate. They're more important than the nature of the components.
Yes.
And a lot more of our behavior and our lives are interaction dominant than we realize. And the interaction dominant systems are not just kind of in our brain and body, but are also groups of people form interaction dominant systems all the time. So that's what I guess that's the real thing I've been poking around at and I'm trying to write a book about.
Very nice. All right, I'm excited. So this is what's on the docket for this next year.
Yeah, for the next year. And I'm still I still work with a bunch of psychology PhD students in the lab on the kind of experiments that this is why I got interested in this, especially because people here do all these social coordination dynamics experiments. So I got very interested in that. There's a Mike Riley, Kevin Shockley, Mike Richardson, and Veronica Ramanzoni, who doesn't work here. She was a grad student here, published a paper in 2011 called Interpersonal Synergies. Mm. And that's where they argue persuasively, I think, that groups of people form units like other biological units. They're just short-lived.
Huh.
I mean, here's a kind of semi-exaggerated version of what I'm trying to say is that, people adjusting their posture so that they can walk together despite their very different leg lengths, which they do skillfully and automatically without being consciously aware of it. And that doing that provides the support for the stuff that we normally think of as intelligent that they're doing. If we weren't walking together, we couldn't have a conversation.
No,
right? if we weren't doing all these bodily adjustments, we couldn't talk, right? Yeah. So we couldn't understand each other. This is more basic.
That's really cool. We typically would. Well, most folks wouldn't pair those together or say one is connected necessarily too much with the other. But
So this Rick might have been to visit Indiana while you were there. I'm not sure. I know he's given talks there recently. Alexander Paxton and Drew Abney, done a bunch of studies where they show that if you look at the kind of patterns of coordination that people engage in, you can actually read off the kind of movement dynamics, whether they're agreeing or disagreeing.
Oh, that's great.
So I mean, these kind of forming of units, right, with people is the basis on which all of our kind of supposedly more intelligent behavior is founded. And what's interesting to me especially is the units that we form with people are a lot like the kind of unities that living things are. They're just short-lived.
Mm.
Right? So the idea, this is the kind of complexity scientist fantasy future as I become to understand, cells as these interaction dominant systems, as organs as interaction dominant systems made of cells, and organisms as interaction dominant systems made of organs, uh-huh. Right? And all the way up the scale with this kind of interaction dominant relationships among the components, all the way up to Gaia. Right?
Yeah.
But, that's almost surely not the future of science. It would be if I got to say what the future of science was, but.
Sure. Well, that's fascinating. I'm looking forward to this new book. This is my only experience with some of the social cognition stuff is learning about some like second person neuroscience work. Is that some of the things that you happen to do?
It isn't. I have never really done much neuroscience.
Okay.
But what you'd be familiar with is the stuff that Rob Goldstone is doing, the scientific psychology that supports the kind of things I'm talking about.
Nice. Do you know Rob at all?
I do. Yeah, I do. A lot of the scientific work I do is in collaboration with Mike Riley or Mike Richardson here. And they both are and talk to Rob all the time. Rob was there when I was a grad student in Indiana as well. So I know him personally, but I didn't work in his lab or anything. Mm-hmm. But I love what he does. It's
yeah, great. No, he's fascinating. He's someone who I feel, he works at, he does a little of both. I mean, he's primarily a cognitive scientist, cognitive psychologist, but, he's very, worked on that group. He has a really great group cognition paper that's really nice and has some, some philosophical bent to it. So,
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of work that I'm talking about. Rob models it a little differently than we do and thinks about it a little differently than we do, but I mean, the results are very similar.
Very nice.
And one other thing that I guess this is something I'm just starting to get interested in and I'm really excited about. Dieter van der Elst is someone we just hired here at Cincinnati, mm-hmm. and he is trying to build robotic bats.
Oh.
And I just started to collaborate with him, and we have a PhD student we share, Carl Mansour. So I'm really excited about digging into robots again. I haven't built robots in a long time.
That sounds super fun.
When he sent me a reading list of, all these things about echolocation, mm-hmm. I'm so excited about this right now. I mean, I'm really excited about it.
That sounds great. That sounds fascinating. All right. Well, why don't we conclude pretty shortly here? Why don't we, if you don't mind, end with some of the things. I think we've already touched on a few of these things probably throughout our interview. Basically, ending on some of the challenges that you see of facing philosophy of science from your point of view.
I think philosophy of science is getting better and better as it goes on, primarily because more young philosophers of science really know about science, having been trained in it, having worked in labs, having degrees in it. And I think that's making things a lot better, and making it so it's harder to make kind of pronouncements about what science is and what science does.
Yeah.
Here's a way to say it, I guess, is that I'm hopeful that we'll kind of continue to move away from general philosophy of science as yeah. The main thing that philosophers of science do, and more into philosophy of this, particular sciences.
Hmm. So I know, yeah. So this is an issue that some folks have been concerned about, the hyper-specialization, maybe of philosophy of science, but you sound in favor of it. So yeah. So why do you think this is, or why do you say this to be the case?
Well, I mentioned earlier that I don't think you can say very much about science in general.
Yeah.
I just think that there's scientific practices are so diverse, and so the assumptions people make are so different from one another that I just don't think you can say a whole lot about what science does or what science is or how science works. So I think it's really good that we are kind of digging in and looking in detail at particular sciences. And now that I'm saying this, I feel like maybe what's happening is we're starting to do something like normal science, philosophy of science.
Yeah.
Right, that's looking carefully at the practice that people do, the details of the practice that people engage in when they do things matter a lot.
Yeah,
and they change quickly, and there's no way to know about them without being on the ground or having been on the ground at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, great.
I mean, I'm sorry, we've been going for a long time, but here's
that's
one.
Okay, no, yeah, yeah.
I'll say is that the first thing that you have to talk philosophy students out of doing when they read science is just reading the, you know, the results and conclusion, right?
Yeah.
Because all the interesting stuff is in the method section. And, you know, when we have philosophers of science who are equally at home reading the method section as they are reading the results and conclusions, then things are going to get a lot more interesting.
This has some really good advice I have not heard so succinctly put. So, I suppose in order to make any some meaningful comments about the methods, you have to be familiar with methods,
at least
to some degree. And that is a big reason why people only read the results and conclusions, is that typically results and conclusions are explained in a more accessible way such to the philosophers.
I think that's right. And I just want to say that I think it was Bill Mace who said to me that, told me that you read the method section first.
Huh. Okay. I appreciate the attribution of that, but that's really great. I think I will definitely keep that in mind myself.
Cool.
All right. Well, Tony, it's been a terrific a little while that we've gotten to chat. I've got to learn a tremendous amount about you and your career. I really appreciate sharing a bit about your story, and looking forward to the Social Cognition book, if you want to call it that, or what it will come to be. Is there anything else you want to say or share before we sign off?
I feel like I've overshared.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. I appreciate this. And it's great to see. I was really excited to hear both about Franklin Marshall as well as the University of Cincinnati, which I did not realize had so many great people as well as such a good program going forward. So hopefully, maybe some interested graduate students might take interest in. You guys do have a master's and PhD programs available?
Really only a PhD program.
Okay. All right, that's good to know. All right, well, yeah. Okay. Well, best of luck this term, getting to write and not teach, and hope to cross paths again soon.
All right, good. Thank you. Keep in touch.
All right, I will do. Okay.